You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, election officials around the country are facing threats from people who have bought into conspiracy theories about the 2020 election and believe there was widespread fraud. We'll talk about what this could mean for future contests. Now, electrical fires aren't always front page news, but a new investigation from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel shows they're a big problem, especially in parts of Milwaukee. The report found most electrical fires are in and around the city's 53206 zip code, an area with a lot of low-income black renters. And even though the fires are suspected to have killed tenants in some cases, officials don't always investigate whether they could have been prevented. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know lived through an electrical fire? Have your landlords taken concerns about electrical issues seriously? If you're an electrician yourself, do you see faulty wiring as a big problem, especially in rental homes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Raquel Rutledge is a Pulitzer Prize-winning public service investigative reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Raquel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
What led you into this story on electrical fires in Milwaukee?
Oh, it's a good question. It's one of those things I've been actually curious about for years as we have seen deaths in around Milwaukee and just been curious about, like, why they are considered to be accidents. We just wondered, are they accidents? Are they preventable? And as we started to look at this and interview experts and electricians, and we found out that they are predictable and preventable. And so we really questioned the premise that these are accidents because we kept seeing people dying and then them just not getting to the bottom of who was accountable for it.
And can you share the story of Patricia Colston, who you focus on a lot in the piece?
Sure. Patricia Colston was a woman who was renting an apartment from a landlord known in Milwaukee to have lots of problems with the city, lots of problems keeping his properties up to code. He sold the building that she was living in, and he offered her to move into another one of his places. And she'd been somewhat desperate. She's a person who suffered from severe arthritis. She was blind in one eye. She had had trouble working and paying rent in the past, so she had a number of evictions on her record already. So she didn't have a lot of options. So she moved into one of his apartments, and within a week, she and a friend of hers were killed by a fire that happened before dawn in October of 2019. And basically, everyone just sort of moved on. You know, the fire investigators came. They said, it looks like it's electrical. And, you would think that, I was surprised to know that they don't investigate electrical fires. Once police and fire investigators, even the state fire marshal, the arson experts, if they don't suspect a crime was committed, they don't, they kind of just leave it at that and say, we just suspect it's electrical, and then they move on. And so, it was just surprising because I think we all sort of assume that that authorities are getting to the bottom of what actually starts these fires.
And what you found, I think in this case and in many others, Raquel, was that often places that had apparent electrical fires had past violations related to the wiring in rental places. What did you find?
Yeah, we definitely did. In a number of cases where tenants had complained repeatedly. I mean, we found some extreme cases where a property had been cited for many years for repeat electrical violations in to such a degree that the owners of the property had warrants out for their arrest because they had just ignored the city for so long that, that they were wanted for, under arrest, but they were still able to rent the properties out. And that was also surprising to us.
Why aren't these things investigated? Usually, as you mentioned, only cases of arson are looked into. There's no actual, I guess, body that goes back and looks into non-intentional but preventable fires?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that is the case. They all say basically it's beyond their scope. It isn't, they don't have electrical engineers on staff at the police department or the fire department. So they basically say, hey, we leave it up to others. And by others, they typically mean insurance companies. And you might think that makes sense because insurance companies a lot of times do come in and they want to get to the bottom of it because they have vested interests, of course. But what we found is that in the city of Milwaukee, A lot of the properties that are being rented, from what we can tell, don't necessarily have insurance. And so in the cases that we wrote about, in the case of Patricia Colston, the property was bought at a sheriff's sale. The owner bought it at a sheriff's sale for $12,000. And so when you're paying cash and not taking out a mortgage, of course, you don't have to have insurance. And so we did a random sample of just 25 properties in that zip code just to see what we could find. And of the sampling, we found that 75% of the properties, the rental properties that we were looking at, did not have mortgages out on them, which means they were not required to have insurance.
Talking to Raquel Rutledge.
So when there's no insurance, there's no further investigation.
Talking to Raquel Rutledge with the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel about a new report on electrical fires in Milwaukee in particular and how they're often not investigated afterward. And Raquel, let's turn toward the front end. People might assume a rental property, it's going to be inspected. If there's dangerous wiring problems, they'll be targeted, fined, and hopefully corrected. What ends up happening?
Yeah, again, I think that's another assumption that people make, that, hey, if you're able to rent a place that somebody, some government agency has deemed it to be safe, you know, deemed it to be inhabitable, and that's just not the case at all. Milwaukee used to have a proactive residential renters inspection program. So in certain neighborhoods that were known to have a preponderance of landlords that were negligent, the city would go in and do an inspection prior to, you know, the property being leased out. And that program was in place for about 5 years, and it was dismantled in 2016 after state legislators, many of whom, some of the lawmakers at the time that passed this legislation, were actually moonlighting as landlords as well, and passed just sweeping laws that really favored landlords and really at the expense of tenants. So there is no residential renters inspection program in Milwaukee any longer, which again, I think it comes to us as a surprise to many people.
Can you talk about the neighborhood that all this is localized in, this particular zip code of Milwaukee?
Yeah. So, I mean, in 53206, we've written a lot about 53206 over the years. It is one of the, let me just say this. So the fires do, that was suspected electrical fires happen in that zip code 5 times the rate of the rest of the city. So it's, you know, it's quite significant there, but also just, it radiates out from there as well. It isn't just localized to that zip code. It is a citywide issue, but it's just worse in 53206. 53206 is 95% African American. 2/3 of the children live in poverty. It's already, it's a zip code that has suffered from really, you know, systemic neglect by government and by corporations, redlining. And so it basically, the people that live there, you know, many are trapped in this substandard housing.
Getting back to enforcement, suppose somebody lives in a house, and as you say, many people observe electrical problems short of fires. Can they make a complaint? How can they get redress? Why might they not do that?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, they can. There's a lot of fear among tenants that they will be, you know, they will be evicted, that they will be, that their rent will be raised, that they'll be retaliated against if they report their landlord. So there's a lot of hesitation. So, you know, that's what all the folks that we interviewed that are familiar with these residential renters inspection programs, that, by the way, other cities across the country, some of the biggest cities in our country have these programs. But the experts say that these complaint-based systems really aren't effective because renters are too afraid. And they're not the experts. Sometimes they don't know. Maybe they don't know that they're buzzing, you know, light switch is a problem, or that, you know, that using extension cords because they only have one outlet in the room that works, they don't necessarily know that that's a hazard. So sometimes, you know, that's why the complaint-based system isn't as effective as, you know, you get eyes on by, you know, experts that can say, hey, that's dangerous.
Raquel, as we wrap up, is anyone pushing to make a change to the way these codes are enforced to prevent future electrical fires?
Well, I do believe some aldermen in the city are starting to talk about it. We've got some calls out to various people. We'll be talking with state legislators again as well to find out. The mayor, as you know, is busy at this he's got some news going on with himself. So we haven't been able to get a direct answer out of him yet, but we're still working on that.
Raquel, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me and for your interest in the story. It's really important and we appreciate it.
That was Raquel Rutledge, public service investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She was with us today to talk about her recent investigation on electrical fires in Milwaukee. Coming up, we continue our discussion about issues facing renters in the state with a look at what's behind long delays in handing out federal emergency rental aid. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a tenant or a landlord dealing with delays for emergency rental assistance? How has that delay impacted you, if so? Do you have questions about if you're eligible or how to get this rental assistance that's out there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now about issues facing renters in Wisconsin. A new report from the U.S. Treasury Department says close to 90% of emergency rental aid hasn't been distributed yet across the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you're experiencing this maybe firsthand. If you're a renter, have you been waiting for this rental assistance? What would it mean for you? If you're a landlord, are you seeing tenants trying to get this? And is it affecting your ability to pay mortgages? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jim Malowitz joins us now. He's deputy managing editor for Wisconsin Watch, which has reported on delays in rental assistance in Wisconsin. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, can you tell us about this rental assistance? Who is it supposed to be going to? What's it supposed to be doing?
Sure. Well, basically, as you set it up, this is rental assistance that's hopefully going to keep tenants in their homes. It's tenants have to apply, but it goes directly to landlords. And both tenants and landlords are interested in this going through because, as you mentioned, landlords have to pay their mortgages and tenants want to stay in their homes. And as you mentioned in your setup, there's a big chunk of this that still has yet to be paid out that social service agencies that are tasked with doing that in Wisconsin are working really, really hard to process those applications.
Why is there such a big delay in getting this money out?
Sure. Well, it's a very, very high demand. There's thousands and thousands of people who have been applying. This application, this is the second major round of federal rental assistance during the pandemic. And it is a little bit more onerous on the bureaucracy than the first round. Some of the folks at the social service agencies have mentioned to our reporter, Vanessa Swales, who was reporting on this for us. So it's a matter of processing applications. It's a matter of making sure that the applications are filled out right by the tenants. And it's also a matter of making sure tenants are communicating with their landlords and that landlords and the social service agencies are connecting as well to make sure that these applications are going through and that the money is reaching the landlords to credit tenants for rent.
Now, who is eligible? If I'm that renter who wants to get this assistance, what do I have to approve or establish to show that I'm eligible?
Sure. So there are income guidelines. I believe it's 80% of a county's median income, and that information is available online to check your county. You also need to have a COVID-19 related, reason for needing this rental assistance for your inability to pay. This doesn't make rent go away. You're still obligated to, try your best to pay rent. But this is really for people who have been affected in some way by COVID. That definition is fairly broad, but who can apply and try to get that assistance. And it's this provides can be up to 15 months of support.
Talking to Jim Malowitz, Deputy Managing Editor for Wisconsin Watch. Talk about Wisconsin Watch's recent reporting on a lag in rental relief aid related to COVID relief packages from the federal government. A lot of the money still not distributed yet. A lot of people still waiting to get that. You can join in if you have an experience, maybe as a renter or a landlord, if you're working for one of the agencies distributing this aid. Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. The Wisconsin Watch piece, Jim, focused in particular on renters in Milwaukee. How big a problem is this there?
Well, it's huge in Milwaukee, and it's probably one of the biggest hot spots for worries about evictions in the state. Housing was already a crisis in Milwaukee before the pandemic, and there you have a very, very high percentage of renters, more renters there than most anywhere else in the state. So those folks were already going to be vulnerable, and it's disproportionately hitting Black and brown communities in Milwaukee as well. Milwaukee is really one of the big areas that we're focused on in making sure that rental assistance meets tenants' needs.
And this is kind of a race against the clock in some ways, right? The eviction moratorium keeps being extended fully or partially. How much of a concern is there that if this money doesn't get to people and that moratorium expires, what could we see happen then?
Well, it's a big concern, and advocates have been saying for months, as this moratorium has been temporary and then temporarily expanded, that there's fears of this tsunami of evictions. Before the pandemic, or right when the pandemic was unfolding across Wisconsin, there were something along the lines of 260,000 households, according to one study, that were potentially at risk of eviction. You know, that was before the pandemic. Facing some risk of eviction. Here you have the pandemic, and it's a really big concern to make sure that the rental aid is meeting folks' needs, because a lot of people had lost their jobs during the pandemic, even as more companies are hiring, that we don't have shutdowns now. There's still really big barriers for people to get to reenter the workforce as well, or to just sort of catch up from those missed payments from big chunks of the pandemic earlier.
As you mentioned, various agencies are doing this depending on where you are in the state. Can you spell out some of the different players who are handling these applications and trying to distribute that money?
Sure. So there's a statewide program. And in that case, it's run by there's an umbrella organization called the Wisconsin Community Action Program Association, and they have local affiliates throughout the state, regional affiliates. So there's something along the lines of 15 organizations under that umbrella that are giving out aid. And then Milwaukee County and the city of Milwaukee run their own separate programs. Dane County and the city of Madison runs a program. And then Brown County as well runs its own separate program. So there's several points for where you could apply. It really it's based upon where you live.
What are these various organizations doing to try to spin up and catch up with these applications?
Sure. Well, they're doing a lot of they're trying their best to follow up with tenants if applications are incomplete. One agency, SDC, the Social Development Commission in Milwaukee, which started processing the second round of federal assistance a little bit later than some, had mentioned that it had a really big backlog of applicants who were, hadn't been contacted, or, their application hadn't been processed from the first round of federal rental assistance when it was doled out in 2020. So there was some level of trying to play catch up there to try to contact applicants to let them know that this was still an option. But there has been some confusion too in Milwaukee from applicants who may have applied in 2020 for assistance and never heard back because there were these backlogs, and then they might not know that there's now this new program or a few months old program that they need to apply again. So it's just a matter of communication with tenants, communications with landlords, and it can be a pretty taxing process.
And your reporter on this talked to some individual people who are affected. What kind of stories are there about what they're having to do to try to make ends meet while they try to get this sorted out?
Sure. Well, one woman who's affected has had trouble juggling caring for her daughter with work. She'd lost work to the pandemic, and it was hard to reenter the workforce because she had to care for her daughter and couldn't find childcare. So it was just a matter of, trying to do anything that she could to get money and to really hope that her application was going to be processed. It's a matter of, piecing together, small odd jobs and things like that, or relying on family as well.
Are there recommendations from the agencies involved here for people in that situation who are waiting, hoping to get this this aid money before the time runs out here? What are they suggesting people do to keep their applications front and center?
Sure. Well, I think one of the top recommendations has been to make sure you're communicating with your landlord, since it is in both of your interests to make sure that that money is coming through, to make sure that the landlord knows you applied and knows that the agency is working on the application. But then it can be a matter of you could call the agency to follow up to see how it's going. But really on the front end, the more you can do to make sure that that application that was originally submitted, the agencies are telling us, is complete, so there aren't any holes in it. So they're not going to have to, call folks back to, get additional documents or anything. That'll really help the process.
In our last minute or so, Jim, what are you watching for next to see if this backlog gets cleared sooner than later?
Sure. Well, I think it's a matter of these agencies. They really are handling an enormous task. This is a large program, larger than I think we've seen in years when it comes to housing. So I think it's a matter of just seeing how the bureaucracy comes together. And as these agencies sort of set up their processes to figure out how to be most efficient. And of course, we have the latest deadline on the ban on certain evictions is October 3rd. So we don't know how much longer that's going to last, but that is one date that we're looking at to see if we can process a lot of applications before that CDC moratorium is up.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Jim Malowitz, Deputy Managing Editor for Wisconsin Watch, with us today to talk about why Wisconsinites face delays in getting federal emergency rental assistance. Up next, we'll look at threats facing election workers at state and local levels. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, dating is always complicated. Dating in the pandemic has been a mess for a lot of people. Jen White shares your stories of love in the time of coronavirus. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, election managers and workers around the country are reporting widespread threats of violence since the November 2020 election. A survey this spring from the Brennan Center found that, quote, one in three election officials feel unsafe because of their job, and nearly one in five listed threats to their lives as a job-related concern, end quote. Those threats are generally linked with unsubstantiated and often debunked claims of fraud in last year's election. Our next guest talked to election officials around the country about the threats they're facing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you worked as an election official or volunteer in your life? We'd love to hear what your experiences have been like. If you were involved in the November 2020 election, what did you see? Did you encounter hostility or threats, or did you feel support from your community? Do you have questions for our guests about the threats that we're seeing for election workers? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Amy Gardner is a national political reporter for The Washington Post. Amy, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Also with us, Rosalind Helderman, political investigations and enterprise reporter, also at The Washington Post. Rosalind, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And they've both reported on these cases of threats to election officials. Rosalind, let's start with you. You looked into Maricopa County, Arizona. There's actually this review going on of the 2020 ballots, results delayed here. What did you hear from election officials in that county about what they're hearing and what threats they're facing?
Yeah, in Maricopa County, which is where Phoenix is, things have been heated for months now as they have been conducting this recount and audit of the election results that was ordered up by Republicans in the state Senate. There's been an ongoing fight between members of the Republican Party in Arizona, especially between the state legislature and the county board of supervisors, the local officials who are also Republicans. And as a result, largely of that fight, the threats have just kept coming and coming, especially to the folks in Maricopa County. There was a dust up of the fight back in June. And as a result of it, some members of the state legislature called for the local officials to actually be jailed. And as a result of that, they were, for the nth time, flooded with threats to their county offices, including the threat to kill all the local elected officials and their families, and even a prison jumpsuit that was sent through the mail to the county offices with a promise that that's where they were headed.
And Amy, you've talked to people in Georgia in particular. What kind of things, and again, another hot spot in the elections, what kind of things did you hear there?
Well, it's very similar to what Roslyn is describing. Basically, some of the election officials that I've been dealing with for, the better part of a year have received such a steady stream of threats in the form of phone calls and emails and even letters sent through the post that they have, contacts with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. And so they just have this regular system of forwarding the threats on to the law enforcement officials who are keeping track and investigating these. One of the top state election officials in Georgia received a letter in the mail a couple of weeks ago that basically accused him of treason and said that he would not be able to safely walk the streets, nor would his family, if he didn't admit his crimes. So it's really rattling, and I think that's the real takeaway here. I also learned from one election official in Michigan a story of a county clerk who had received threatening phone calls and had set up a little habit, a pattern of when she gets home from work each evening, she checks her closets, because that's how rattled and scared she is, and how scary this is as a trend that's happening everywhere.
The Brennan Center for Justice put out a policy paper last month. You included this in your reporting. Looking at this national problem, along with the report, they put out a short video talking to some election officials, and they gave an example of a phone message left for an official here. Let's give a listen. It includes multiple obscenities, which have been bleeped out here by the Brennan Center.
He will demand the truth, and you will pay for your lying remarks, you liberal lying rhino. We will take you out, your family, your life. You watch your back.
Can you, Rosalind, that gives a sense of some of the vitriol in the threats people are getting. Is that all that uncommon?
Unfortunately, it's really not. I was talking to an official out in Arizona, in fact, just yesterday, who said that he now gets so many of these threats that he sort of lets them wash over him. But he was talking about how he had just gotten one this past week that was essentially the content was, we are everywhere. We are preparing your food when you go out to eat. We are stocking your groceries when you're at the grocery store. We are everywhere you look, all around you at all times. And he said that one. That one kind of got to him.
We are talking to Rosalind Helderman and Amy Gardner with the Washington Post, looking at threats targeting election officials in states around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234 for your thoughts on what is causing those threats, possible solutions, and if you've worked as an election official yourself, a paid or volunteer. And if you'd just like to share your experience, tell us a little bit about what you do, whether you were on the receiving end of threats or not. Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Amy, what did you hear from people about cumulatively what these threats are doing to them and affecting their thoughts on their job?
A couple of different things. First, it's changing the way election officials are doing their job. There's two big national organizations that help election officials in on-the-job learning and continuing education and trends and standards and practices. And one is the National Association of State Election Directors, and the other one is the National Association of Secretary of State. And those organizations happen to have had their summer conferences a couple of weeks ago, early August. And in both cases, the agendas, which are typically really mundane technical stuff, like what's the best design for a ballot, or, recruiting election officials, or, just really basic stuff on how to run elections well and smoothly. Both of those had security of election officials at the top of their agendas. I'm looking at the conference agenda for the National Association of State Election Directors, and their top item was addressing physical threats to elections and election officials. They also had to actually, in one case, one of these conferences was virtual, but the other one was in person, in Iowa, and they actually had to step up security as a precautionary matter for the conference itself, because there were going to be hundreds of election officials at this conference. So they involved the FBI and state law enforcement and local law enforcement at this conference to make sure that they would be safe during the conference itself. But perhaps the most significant sort of fallout of this is what we don't know yet, and that is how this will affect the administration of the midterm elections next year. And of course, there are some off-year elections this year, notably in Virginia and New Jersey. And how will election officials recruit poll workers and election workers in this environment? And how will what kind of effect will these threats and this general atmosphere of fear and intimidation have on the administration of elections? It's a group of people who are claiming that our elections are crooked, and yet the fact of their behavior and their activity has this grave potential to undermine the integrity of our elections by making it difficult for these officials to do their jobs well.
Rosalind, is there a concern that, some people are going to retire and maybe with these threats, this doesn't look like such a hot job that a lot of people are going to step up and want to do? Is there a thought that we're not going to have enough people to run elections if this trend continues?
There's a tremendous concern about that. There was actually a survey this summer from Reed College and the Democracy Fund of election officials, and it found that 60% of election officials in the country's largest jurisdictions were considering retirement. And of course, you have to remember also that elections are run largely, not entirely, but in good measure by volunteers, people from the local community who agree to come out. And it's helpful when they work election cycle after cycle, because elections are complicated, and it's helpful to have people who know the ropes and have done it before. And so there's great concern that the professionals will retire and the volunteer base will dry up, because people will not want to be subjected to this kind of thing anymore.
Amy, I should ask kind of a long-term thing. Elections are always kind of heated. Is there a sense that, there's always some of this and things have gotten somewhat worse? Or is this a whole different animal this last, 8 months or so?
I would say the latter. I mean, we've seen a level of mistrust infuse the electorate over the last year that we haven't seen before, and that is measurable in terms of not just the threats that we've written about and that we're talking about now, but also, a lot of these folks won't vote and won't vote by mail or won't vote at all. And that's a direct result of what they perceive to be this erosion of the security and sanctity of elections. So, it's a real and immediate and sort of huge impact, because voting by mail, for instance, used to be a type of voting that Republicans did more than Democrats just a couple of years ago. It was a type of voting that Republican officials
sort of championed and encouraged among their supporters as a way to get ballots in. And that's reversed over the last year. So that tells you that something kind of seismic has happened. The other point that I think is important to make here is that you have these folks who are so angry and are so sort of intractable and don't want things explained to them, are unwilling to hear what people, the election officials, are trying to tell them about the security of the election. And so there's this polarization, and obviously that's the word that we use all too often to describe our political environment. But the polarization over elections itself is just grown very wide right now because of this.
We're talking to Amy Gardner and Rosalind Helderman from The Washington Post about threats to election workers at state and local levels around the country since the 2020 election. Lots of threats, lots of election workers saying they're feeling threatened. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think this should be handled? Should election officials get more protection? What do you think needs to happen to dial down the temperature and prevent these threats in the first place? Have you worked as an election official yourself? What do you think about what you're hearing about these threats? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about threats and intimidation of election workers with Amy Gardner, national political reporter at The Washington Post, and Rosalind Helderman, political investigations and enterprise reporter, also with The Post. They co-authored a piece looking into threats that officials have received all around the country since the 2020 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your questions, maybe your experiences if you've worked on elections yourself. Let's go to your calls now. Kurt is with us in Chippewa Falls. Kurt, hi.
Yes, hi. Yeah, I hate to sound so vitriolic myself against fellow Americans, but these folks, the FBI, local law enforcement, whatever, need to do whatever is possible to trace them down, track them down, find them, arrest them, charge them with terrorism, and put them through the court system and appropriately sentence them to years in jail.
Kurt, thanks for the call. Rosalind, that takes us to enforcement. What kind of things are we seeing when it comes to investigating these, especially when it comes to direct threats of violence against election officials?
Yeah, the Justice Department actually announced this summer, I believe, a new task force to look specifically at the issue of threats of violence against election staff. They sort of indicated that they want to step up efforts to do exactly what the caller just described, to investigate people who make threats and prosecute those who have broken the law in doing so. It's not easy for the same reason as investigations that involve online chatter. It's often not easy. It often comes anonymously. It often is sort of a vague threat that's hard to act on. It often starts to get into people's First Amendment rights, because you obviously don't have a right to threaten violence, but you have a First Amendment right to get awfully nasty. And so it can be a tricky topic area, but the Justice Department has stated very strongly that they believe that threatening election workers is a threat to democracy itself, and they are going to be looking to make more federal cases in these instances.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kurt. We'll go to Joanna now in Eau Claire. Joanna, hi.
Good afternoon. I think that our election workers are doing a phenomenal job. They're mostly volunteers. They're all volunteers. They're doing the best that they can, and they're just great people. They work long hours. I'm so curious as to how these members of the Republican Party can convince seemingly normal people to make the claim that our elections have been fraudulent when they haven't. It's just simply not true. And then they allow themselves to engage in this cult-like behavior. That's my question. But as far as the poll workers are concerned, they're doing a phenomenal job right now.
Joanne, thanks a lot for that call. Amy, to her second point, are we seeing these threats tied into particular claims about alleged fraud in the November elections? I think you mentioned that some of them go with the Sharpie conspiracy that was debunked already in November, I think. Are these dots pretty well connected?
I think that the threats and the misinformation and the anger come from a few different, under a few different categories. Pretty much all have been debunked, or at least no evidence has surfaced to show that these accusations are accurate. And to the caller's point, I think that the genesis of this anger is, first, of course, former President Trump, who, is extremely popular with his base, and that base was extremely upset that he didn't win. And he told them that the election was stolen, and they believed him. And so I think that's sort of the beginning of this, in a way. And then, of course, social media is a place where, inaccurate or unsubstantiated claims circulate all the time, all over the place, under all different kinds of categories, and the elections are no different. But they've taken root, they've caught fire, whatever metaphor you want to use, and people have latched onto them because Trump was extremely popular. He was a president for whom nearly half of the electorate felt very deeply that he listened to them in a way that others hadn't in recent election cycles and recent presidencies. And so there was a lot of disappointment and despair in that part of the electorate that he lost. And then to be told, well, he didn't really lose, was an easy step for people who didn't want to believe that he'd really lost. And I think that's where this came from. The tricky part is how to try to explain to folks that what they're hearing and being told isn't true. And that's really hard to do. It's hard to tell someone you don't understand how elections are run, but that's what election officials are telling us. They're so frustrated when they try to patiently sit down with people who come in or who email them or who call and say, no, that's not how the Dominion voting systems machines work. No, they're not attached to the internet. No, they haven't been hacked by Venezuelans. No, Biden's votes weren't switched to Trump. That can't happen, and here's why. And it just falls on deaf ears. They do not want to hear it.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Rosalind Helderman and Amy Gardner from the Washington Post about threats against election officials around the country since last November. Back to your calls now with Scott on the line in Madison. Scott, hi.
Hey, how's it going? My question was more like, so are these threats coming from people all over the country? So if you're in Georgia, are you getting a threat from somebody from Alaska, or is it local? Or, I'm just trying to figure out. I mean, we tend to think, oh, we're Midwest nice. They aren't going to do that here in Wisconsin. Maybe that's in the South or whatever. But I was just curious if there was any correlation, or whether it's just a smaller group that's angry that's threatening people everywhere.
Scott, thanks a lot for that call. Rosalind, in the piece, you focus on, I think, Arizona, Michigan, and Georgia. It's got to be tough to trace where the threats are coming from. It could be local. It could be from anywhere, right?
It's true. I hate to say I grew up in the South, where people also tell themselves they're nice. These calls and threats are not nice in the Midwest, in the South, in Arizona, in Georgia. And you're exactly right. It is not the case that the threats in Wisconsin all come from Wisconsin. This world of social media means that, we have seen instances where random anonymous election workers are caught in a snippet of video doing something completely innocuous, but it gets caught up in the pro-Trump media ecosphere with a claim that they are doing something not innocuous. And suddenly a person who is just a worker in Georgia, a worker in Texas, is inundated with threats and nasty comments and emails from all over the country. And so, in the information sphere that we have these days, People can learn about situations anywhere, and they can make threats anywhere, and it's not local at all.
Thanks a lot for that call. Amy, I don't want to let the time get away from us without mentioning another big source of stress for anyone involved in elections last year, the pandemic. Apart from these threats, could you talk about how much that changed lives for anyone involved in election planning?
Well, that's one of the great sort of mysteries of how angry some of these folks are at election workers who literally risked their lives to put on an election last year and whose efforts to make voting easier because of the pandemic were tossed back in their faces as evidence of their attempts to try to sway the election for President Biden. So you had in Georgia leading up to the election, one of the main election officials in Fulton County, which is where Atlanta is, died of COVID just weeks before the election. And that office had to deal with that tragedy and also deal with the illness of other people in the office and put on a presidential election and put in all kinds of protocols that they'd never done before, as every institution and business and school and family in America has had to do, but still under great pressure to put on an election while also building plexiglass separators for polling locations and having enough hand sanitizer to get around and having the capacity to keep people socially distanced and maybe not in the rain or not in the cold. I mean, all of those things times a thousand across the country were happening last year. And then when it was over, instead of any kind of gratitude from half of the electorate, these folks got nothing but derision and worse, as we've been talking about.
And Rosalind, in our last little over a minute or so, looking to the future, what kind of efforts are there to make sure that there are enough election officials around the country and that they can do their job safely?
We've talked a little bit about some of the education efforts that are going on through the professional associations around security, some of the stepped up investigations from law enforcement agencies. But I don't know that there is has yet been a sort of comprehensive or cohesive effort to move on from 2020 and start thinking about how this current environment might affect the midterms and the presidential election to come, including the recruiting of new employees and volunteer poll workers. And that's kind of the challenge to come. How do we run elections going forward in this environment?
We'll leave it there. Rosalind, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Amy, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Amy Gardner is a national political reporter for The Washington Post, and Rosalind Helderman is a political investigations and enterprise reporter for The Washington Post. We talked to them about their reporting on election officials around the country being intimidated and threatened by people upset with the outcome of the 2020 election. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow at 8, get a preview of the big acts at this year's Summerfest and a look at the safety precautions in place for the outdoor music festival. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, according to a news report, the FBI is not treating the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol as a centrally coordinated effort by far-right groups or staunch supporters of former President Trump. We'll get the latest on that, plus a little more information on Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett and his appointment as an ambassador. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time at WPR.org. Stream the Ideas Network live or dig deep into our extensive archives. You can also download the Wisconsin Public Radio app to do both of those things as well. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.